G'day everyone, welcome back to the show. Episode 197, can't believe it. We are fast approaching the 200 here, and I think coming up to the 550th podcast episode I've ever recorded. So that is quite the milestone. I'm very excited about that. And this episode of the show is The Secret Life of You with writer Kerry Sackville. So I came across this book. It was actually a client of mine who recommended it to me. And it's an area of my life that I'm really starting to embrace. It's alone time, solitude, really trying to go inward, I suppose, and have a think about who I am and who I want to be. And I think, you know, as Kerry mentions many times, and as the slogan of the MindMate podcast used to be, the best way to get to know yourself is to spend time with yourself. And this is this book in very in a lot of ways. Was a reflection as to what I needed and where I was in my life when I read it, and just a fantastic book. I can't recommend it enough. The Secret Life of You by Kerry Sackville. It's really, really great. Very, very easy to read, which I think is a reflection of how good she is as a writer when she can break down, you know, relatively complicated ideas in language that is accessible and understandable for many of us. I absolutely loved having her on the show. So Kerry Sackville is an Australian author, columnist, and social commentator. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including the Sunday Times UK, SBS Life, News.com, Mamma Mia, the Australian Women's Weekly, and Prevention Magazine. A longtime contributor to the Sydney Morning Herald, Melbourne Age, and Sunday Life magazine, Kerry's columns are regularly amongst the most widely read across the sites. Kerry has written 5 works of nonfiction and contributed to 3 anthologies. Her latest book is The Secret Life of You, How a Bit of Alone Time Can Change Your Life, Relationships, and Maybe Even the World. Kerry is a regular guest on ABC Radio, commercial radio, and podcasts around the country, including now, obviously, the MindMate podcast. She lives in Sydney's eastern suburbs with her kids and cat, and can be found on Instagram at Kerry Sackville or on Facebook at facebook.com/Kerry.Sackville. And without further ado, here is Kerry Sackville. Thanks, guys. Kerry, welcome to the show.
So good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. Like I said, it was really short notice, but I really wanted to reach out. I think I was reading your book on my Kindle, and like I said to you in the email, because my partner and I will often read together. I was like, oh, you got to read this. She was getting so annoyed at me because she was like,
it's so annoying when people, like I do it too, but it's so annoying. I know. Yeah. Like, you know, you're listening and you just want to get back to your own book. It's like, okay, Tom, you know, just, I'm so glad you're enthusiastic, but can you let me read?
I know. Yeah, totally. I feel like I'm like the kind of guy that would just tell everyone that, you know, Luke Skywalker was Darth Vader's son the first time
in Star Wars. Yeah, you would. You would.
I have that tendency.
Yeah, ruin it for everyone.
That's right.
Lucky my book doesn't have like a twist ending or anything like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we woke up and it was all a dream. That's the end of it. Look, Kerry, for those that aren't aware of who you are and what you do, do you want to give the audience just a brief rundown?
Yeah, I'm Luke Skywalker's father.
Well, no, there you go.
I'm not.
And that's the end of the show.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm a writer. I call myself a writer. I work as a columnist for Sydney Morning Herald, Melbourne Age, Brisbane Times, what used to be Fairfax, what's now the 9 group of newspapers. And I'm an author. So I've written 5 books and contributed to 3 anthologies. And The Secret Life of You is my 5th book.
Yes, beautiful. Just on that, with writing as an identity, I feel like writing is such a creative pursuit, and a lot of people that I've spoken to about, you know, their creative arts, whatever it is, where it's sculpting or painting or writing, they have a tough time with identities and titles, you know, because it's, in this day and age, we all kind of define ourselves in that way. But if you're on the creative path, creative is such, it's such an expansive thing that to name and give yourself just a rigid identity, it's almost limiting in a way. Have you kind of tussled with that in your life at all?
No, I think for me it was more, when did I feel I could call myself a writer? Mm. You know, when did I have the right? I think it was probably more imposter syndrome for a long time. You know, I'm I'm basically a freelancer, but I've been contributing to, you know, the Herald for many, many years. And I think the reason why I can embrace writer is because I'm not a journalist. I didn't train as a journalist, but I've written in different ways pretty much most of my career. I actually started off my life, I studied English and linguistics at uni. I did start off doing a Bachelor of Arts. And then a couple of years into it, I kind of had this panic that it wasn't vocational enough and I wouldn't be able to forge a career as a writer. So I switched to social work and I worked as a social worker for several years and then in sort of related areas and then came back into writing after my kids were born. And so I sort of started off my writing career. I mean, I'd been writing in all the different jobs that I held and I wrote a lot at school and at uni. But then I started off my writing career as a blogger back when blogging was just taking off. So my writing sent me through all different iterations, blogging, the books, the columns, and then the, you know, I guess the copywriting work that I did in my different jobs. So the overreaching title is writer, and I'm really comfortable with that. But as I said, it took a while to feel that I could, you know, I was worthy of calling myself a writer. And, it took quite a bit of published work and probably a couple of books before I thought, yes, I'm allowed to say this. I'm a professional writer. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I always joke about it, but I think it's pretty true. I don't really have any other marketable skills. So I kind of have to stick with it now. You know, I can't cook and I'm not a great cleaner and you know, my management skills aren't terrific. So this is what I do.
Yes, yes. And you've been able to find your lane with all the different ways in which you have used writing to harness different vocations.
Well, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of your book, The Secret Life of You. It actually made me think a lot about Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. I really enjoyed that book.
Yeah,
she speaks a lot about you know, this idea about doing enough in order to be enough. You know, and kind of what you were speaking about there, just going to uni and having the skills to be able to apply to certain vocations and so forth, and how difficult that is for creativity, because almost by definition it is a new thing that you're a new gift that you're giving to the world. I think I was wondering if you could speak to that, Kerry, just for the upcoming artist, writer, whatever it is, how they can find that transition from giving that gift and being able to hold that identity. As you said, it took you quite a while. So,
yeah, I you know, I'm not big on regrets. I think everything that you do kind of leads you to the point where you are, and obviously there's just no point looking back and having regrets. But if I did have one career regret, it's that I didn't feel confident enough to start my writing career earlier. And I wonder if I hadn't had that freak out and switched careers and switched lanes, if I'd stuck with it and felt confident enough, at least attempting it, where I could have been by now. And it's not that doing social work wasn't valuable and taught me a huge amount. And I think, you know, the creative arts often goes hand in hand with other professions, and particularly things like social work, psychology. You know, you find a lot of lawyers who are writers, doctors, because anything that's to do with people and working with people, and just a fascination with human nature. But I think if you have a passion for something, the best thing you can do is just to practice it. And we kind of justify all the time the reasons why we shouldn't, but we need to actually justify why we can. It doesn't mean that you launch yourself into it to the exclusion of everything else. You know, I think I wrote something about it many years ago. I remember watching, I think it was The Voice or one of those talent shows, and the judges would say to every one of the contestants who came along, you know, you've got to prove yourself by leaving your job and dedicating yourself to this 100%. And if you don't, then you're not truly committed. And I don't believe that at all. Like, I think that it's really good to have a safety net and to have other skills to fall back on. And I did have this other career, and now I'm at the point where, you know, when I say I have no other marketable skills, you know, I've just done writing for so long, it would be hard to move into something else. But it you don't have to do it full time. It's not an all or nothing thing, but just start. And the number of people I meet who say, oh, you know, I've got a book in me, or, you know, I'd love to write, or I'm an aspiring writer. Well, you can.
Yes.
Like, you don't have to be aspiring. You can literally just start writing now, or painting, or sculpting, or dancing, whatever you want to do. You don't have to wait for an opportunity. You can start 10 minutes a day, half an hour a day.
Mm, yeah.
So I think that's the key, is just do it.
I love that. And I think that's a really lovely segue into The Secret Life of You. And I think, my computer's making all sorts of noises here at the moment. One of the things that I really love about your book is that it offers just a little bit. You know, it's not like now you need to be a meditator in a cave for 10 hours a day. It's just, and I've actually taken this on in my own life. We live about 3 minutes away from a shopping center. And instead of calling someone, because I'm quite an extroverted person, I don't. And I have a little bit of time to just daydream and wander. And the difference is phenomenal.
So you mean when you're walking to the shops?
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
It's one of the biggest takeaways that I took from your book. It's what can I apply today to just be 1% better, you know? And I think even just little moments of time with myself, as you say, you know, the best way to get to know yourself is to spend time with yourself.
Yes.
I think it's been phenomenal for my own growth. So,
I'm so glad. Well, yeah. Well, see, the book is about the importance of spending time alone with your thoughts. And one thing that I realized is that when I, you know, I'm in my 50s now, when I was growing up, I had many, many incidental moments of solitude throughout the day, every day, because I didn't have a choice. So once I was old enough to have my own bedroom, if I was in my bedroom, I was alone and I was properly alone. We didn't have a telephone that stretched to my bedroom. There was one telephone. It was in the kitchen. If I wanted to call my friend, I had to walk into the kitchen, pick up the phone, dial her house, probably get onto her mum, ask to speak to her if she was home, and then speak to her in full view of my family.
Yes.
Right? I didn't get a clock radio, I think, till I was 12 or 13. I didn't have a television in my room till I was, I think, 19 or 20. I think till I almost moved out. And so every time I was in my room, I was alone with my thoughts. I was either reading, writing, or just thinking. If I was walking to school, if I was sitting on the bus, if I was driving when I was old enough to drive, I would be alone with my thoughts. And nowadays, because of the prevalence of mobile devices, it seems like every idle moment we reflexively pick up our phones. And so we've lost that knack of being alone with our thoughts, and we don't need to be alone with our thoughts. So being idle is almost like this problem to be solved with connectivity. So what I'm suggesting in the book is not that we go off on a, you know, 10-day silent retreat and learn to be alone. It's just having those little moments during the day so that when you're in your car, you know, you're on your way to the shops, or when you're walking to the shops, or when you're in the bath, or when you're pottering around your house, you don't, as much as I love podcasts, this is the podcast, don't have to be connected all the time. So have time without a podcast, have time without picking up your phone. If you're sitting in a doctor's waiting room for 10 minutes, maybe just try sitting and thinking. You know, it's so interesting because when I look back to when I used to catch a bus, the meme, we didn't even have memes then, but the meme would be everybody sitting staring out the window. That's what you would see when you look around a bus. Now what do you see? See everybody looking down at their phone. Yeah. And there's such wasted opportunities to actually be connected to ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I think in this day and age, it's like the desires that we want and that are pleasurable are almost proportional to the pain that we experience on an everyday basis. And this idea now to go and find ourselves on this incredible journey, it's like a complete 180, really can be managed by what you're saying, just little pockets of time to ourselves. We can integrate that into the ways we live our lives. We don't need to go to India and find ourselves and experience.
It's like what we were just talking about. You know, people saying, I want to write, you know, but they're waiting for the right time, and they're waiting for this great expanse of time when they can sit down and write a book in, you know, take a month off to write a book. But you don't need to do that. You can actually just write for 10 minutes a day, and you don't need to wait for this time to go and find yourself and go to India and meditate on a hill. You actually can start just by taking little moments every day. And I think it's almost an excuse. It's a way to say, I can't right now. I'm too busy. There's too much going on. I'll put that off. Yeah, I'll put off my big, you know, journey towards learning how to be alone for another time. But it's just a muscle that you develop like any other muscle.
Yes.
And that you can start literally right now in the incidental moments in your day.
Yeah. There's one thing I really wanted to bring up with you, almost from the outset of the show, which was this, the culture that we live in that really favors the extrovert. That was not something that I'd really seen before, because I find myself in that category, right? The lovely person who I'm with, she's very much an introvert. And I really love the way that you phrase that, because number one, I agree with it. But in fact, before we get into it, could you elaborate on that for me?
Yeah. So this is an idea actually was explored in a book by Susan Cain called Quiet, which is The Power of Introverts. I think it's The Power of Introverts in a World that Won't Stop Talking. And it's something that I had seen because when I was, you know, thinking about solitude and researching it, it's so clear that our society does not value time spent alone. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is our society's favoring extroversion. And so you see that in the way that, you know, in the workplace where we favor collaboration, open plan offices, everything is about group work in schools, everything is about working together, and you know, and this notion that the person who is confident in public and can be social and can be outspoken is the one who's going to get ahead in life. And you know, it's funny, I was doing a talk the other day and a couple of teachers approached me and they said, you know, this really resonated with them because they know that in schools they see it all the time, that these kids who are perfectly happy sitting in a corner reading and, yes, and just entertaining themselves and being lost in their thoughts, the teachers are worried, the parents are worried, trying to get them to be more social, more outgoing, when in fact they're perfectly fine as they are. And instead of looking at them saying, wow, this child has such rich inner resources, we're saying, oh no, why aren't they more social? So Susan Cain called it the extrovert ideal, which is the idea that we value people who are extroverted. And there's a lot of reasons why this is not necessarily a great idea for a society. You know, extroverts bring a huge amount to the table, but introverts bring something as well, which is not valued, which is that quiet introspection, which is contemplation, and which is the kind of ideas that are generated in solitude.
Yes.
So one thing, you know, that I kept reading repeatedly is that a lot of great innovators of the last, you know, the last kind of 20, 30, 40 years were saying that if they had been at that stage of their career now, where everything is about group work and collaboration, they would not have had the space and the time to come up with their ideas. Because you need time alone to be able to think of you know, great ideas and to have original thought. And the great problem with group work and collaboration is which ideas get noticed. Is it the best ideas, or is it just the ideas that are put forward by the people who are the most confident public speakers and with the loudest voices? So, you know, my middle child, who's currently at uni, is an introvert, and she has wonderful ideas and incredibly creative, but she finds it very hard to convey those ideas in a big group. So does that mean that her ideas aren't worth hearing, or does it just mean that maybe the way that we share ideas is flawed?
Yes.
And that we need to be able to adapt that so that the introverts can get their thoughts and their original thoughts and their ideas across as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I actually really, on the flip side, love about our society today, is that there are so many different ways to convey ideas. You know, obviously there's podcasting, but, you know, anyone who's artistic can start a Pinterest account or an Instagram account or a blogging account. If you don't find that you're comfortable in front of a camera, you know, it's the idea, hopefully, that we can get to rise to the top. Kerry, for you, was that validating? Do you see yourself as more of an introvert and that was quite validating, or do you see yourself as more of an extrovert and then there was a pull to kind of harness that other side as well?
Yeah, I've always seen myself as what I'll call an extroverted introvert. So I'm definitely an ambivert. So I think most of us fall on the spectrum, and as I'm sure you know, but for people who are listening, if they don't know, you know, basically introversion, extroversion is just where you get your energy.
Right.
So an introvert gets their energy and feels best when they're alone. And so recharges by spending time in solitude, whereas an extrovert gets energy from other people. So I've always needed both. I've always needed, you know, time with other people, and I feel, you know, agitated if I don't get to spend time with people or talk to people. But then I get incredibly I get incredibly agitated and incredibly antsy when I don't get time by myself. So I've always needed that balance. And what I found really difficult about lockdown, you know, here in Sydney when we were in lockdown for so long, was that it was bad on both counts because,
yeah,
A, I didn't get to socialize, but also I didn't get proper time alone because I was locked down in an apartment with three kids. So it fell apart on both counts. And that was an incredibly difficult time for me. So now, you know, I know to balance it. But I see, you know, I know with, as I said, one of my kids is really a proper introvert. And until I sort of did this research and, you know, did a deep dive into why our culture is so biased towards extroverts, I was one of those parents who would think, oh no, you know, I need to get her ready for this kind of extroverted world, and I need to draw her more out of her shell. And in fact, she's great how she is. And she has very rich connections, but she has, you know, fewer and less time socializing and more time by herself, but then she produces this amazing art, and that's the flip side of it.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, no, I really like that. And I think, yeah, the pandemic was a wonderful, devastating challenge for adaptation, you know, for a lot of us who were lucky enough not to be, I suppose, directly experienced by death and suffering and so forth. It sounds to me like that the book really kind of came about from the lessons and the struggles from the pandemic.
It came about, I think the pandemic brought it to a head, but it came really from the lessons and struggles from, I think, my whole life.
Sure.
And, you know, one of the things I talked a lot about in the book was the way that my fear of being alone kind of led me to some really bad decisions, particularly in terms of relationships. So by the time the pandemic hit in 2020, I'd been divorced for 8 years, and I had, you know, it was a very difficult marriage, very difficult separation. And then I had a series of incredibly toxic relationships that I got into really because I had no idea how to be alone. You know, I'd been in back-to-back relationships since I was 17. And then got divorced at 46 and had never spent time on my own. And so it was the relationship aspect. And then it was also when I found myself in lockdown feeling it was a very difficult time for me on many counts. And, you know, one of them was because I was never alone, but I also wasn't socializing. I couldn't date, and I'd been using dating, I think, as a distraction for a long time. I lost a lot of my work because I work in the media, and that took a huge dive in COVID. And I found myself spending hours and hours and hours, almost obsessively, like scrolling through my phone. And I know now that it was because I was feeling deeply disconnected and deeply lonely. And so I was turning to my phone for that kind of connection. And of course, that just made me feel more lonely and more disconnected. And I really came to a crisis point where I thought, I have to do something different because I'm not doing well here at all. And I decided to do almost an experiment and stop using my phone and put it down and learn to just sit with these very, very painful, difficult emotions that were not just the loneliness of the pandemic, but the loneliness from the previous several years. And, you know, I write in the book, I dislike the word journey, but it was really a journey.
Sure.
And it was an incredibly challenging thing to do. And when I started going for walks without my phone and sitting, you know, under a tree without my phone and just spending time sitting with these very painful emotions. And every fiber in my being was calling out for distraction. I just wanted to pick up my phone or call someone or scroll through something or look at a meme. And I didn't. And I learned over a period of time a couple of different things. One is that difficult emotions pass when you sit with them, because I'd been pushing them aside and trying to distract myself from them for so long. And what they do is they just simmer away and they eventually come back to bite you on the bum. And the other thing I learned was to support and nurture and comfort myself the way that I had sought that kind of nurturing from other people and the way that I gave that to other people. And again, it's a skill that you can learn where, you know, normally if I was feeling bad, I would want somebody else to make me feel better. And I learned to actually be able to make myself feel better. And now that I am in a relationship and a healthy relationship, obviously I've got a very supportive and nurturing partner, but the first stop is always myself. So my first port of call always, if I'm feeling bad or I'm feeling concerned or I'm not sure what I think about something, I will always turn to myself first before I turn to someone else. And I think that is so important for resilience, and just to be able also to have healthy relationships, that we are, you know, deeply connected to ourselves before anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think as well, and I can't speak to this with any direct experience, but something that you point out in the book as well is the stigma of the single or the divorced, middle-aged sort of woman. And you kind of feel into that and the way people respond to you. It's like, oh, when are you going to date again? You write really, quite well about this in your book. Was a lot of that on this journey, to use that word, was a lot of your growth being able to kind of separate and see that that's other people's stuff and not somehow connected to your own worth? Yeah.
And it's not just middle-aged people. I mean, sure. I think that there is a huge stigma in our society against being single. Mm. Stop. And also not just being single, being alone, doing things alone, living alone, people equate living alone with loneliness when the research shows that that is not true. In fact, most people who live alone are actually very social and are very good at socializing because they're forced to leave their homes to socialize. Mm. And living alone is such a privilege in our society when so many people can't afford to live alone and have to have housemates or move back in with family. But we just assume that somebody living on their own is going to be lonely. And we assume that somebody who is single is unhappy and is unsatisfied and is kind of, the way I visualize it, it's sort of like you're on this waiting area, like a train platform waiting to find the train to happy couple town. And in fact, being single is a perfectly valid way to move through life. And I had some very, very happy times when I was single. And there's lots of huge advantages to it as well. You can do what you want to do. You don't have to answer to anyone. You're not dependent on anyone in terms of finances or making decisions. But we have an enormous bias in our society towards relationships as like the locus of all happiness. And relationships can bring you enormous happiness, but there are many other sources of happiness and satisfaction as well, things like career and hobbies and just our own inner lives. Mm. And also, I think with this intense focus on relationships and assuming that people can only be happy in relationships, what it does is it drives people into relationships that aren't necessarily healthy or satisfying because we feel that being in a relationship, any relationship, is better than being single. And that was a mistake that I made. I had no idea how to be single. I felt very keenly the society pressure to be coupled up. And so I found myself hanging in there in relationships which really weren't serving me because the alternative seemed too scary and also just too unknown. And of course, when you are afraid to be alone and you will tolerate anything in a relationship just to keep yourself in a relationship, you're incredibly disempowered.
Yes.
You have no power in the relationship whatsoever. And I think it's a huge shame, and I'm doing my bit to change the stigma. I hope it changes more because it is far, far better to be alone than to be in the wrong relationship, and you feel far lonelier lying next to the wrong person than you do lying in your own bed alone at night.
Yeah.
I can say that from bitter experience.
Yeah, that's really, really valuable, and I feel quite privileged. I work as a therapist, and I say this all the time on my podcast. I do it so I can learn more about myself. I do it for very selfish reasons. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to have beautiful conversations with the absolute authentic truth of who someone is in that moment, and all of their stuff and I find myself almost repeating myself on the podcast and when I'm working with people, that so much of our struggle that we internalize as an individual issue is just part of what it means to be human, and not knowing things and all the stigmas and the bullshit that we've, been brought into within the culture and everything like that. And it's, uh, I, what you just said that I think will be really, really validating for a lot of people who feel that way. You know, it's just this fear of loneliness, not necessarily because they themselves have a specific issue with loneliness. They might, but it's exacerbated and catalyzed so much more by the culture that we live in, which is, as you said, everything from the way we grew up, the movies that we watch, how every wonderful love story ends with the first kiss. And that's the epitome of the goal that we're all trying to reach.
Yeah.
It's really the first kiss. I mean, my first kiss was rather lovely, but I was like 15.
Yeah.
It's like a very long time.
But that's where the story begins. And there's more stories of it, but what we rarely see is then just how difficult it is to be in a relationship. And that doesn't mean that relationships aren't wonderful, can be wonderful and worthwhile, but the idea of a relationship at all costs is so toxic.
Totally.
And I think one of the greatest misconceptions about loneliness is that the cure for loneliness is company or the cure for loneliness is a relationship, because that's not true. The cure for loneliness is connection, right? And the first connection always has to be with ourselves. And the less connected we are with ourselves, the more lonely we're going to be. And the less connected we are with ourselves, the poorer our relationships are going to be, because we're going to be using other people to try and fill gaps in ourselves instead of actually seeing them for who they are and enjoying their company for who they are. And we risk enmeshment and we risk being in toxic relationships. If we're lonely, the best thing we can do is to learn to comfort and nurture and support ourselves and to keep ourselves company. And everything else comes from there. Our relationships improve. We are less lonely. We have richer connections with other people.
Mm.
But again, this is a whole kind of society trope that, you know, the lonely person just needs to go out and be in company more. But when you're lonely, when you're not connected to yourself, you find that your relationships aren't, and I, you know, go into all this in the book, but your relationships tend not to be satisfying anyway, because that lack of connection to yourself means that you don't see yourself, and so you don't feel seen by other people.
Yes.
You know, what do we want? What do we want in our relationships? We want to be seen. We want to feel seen. You know, I want to feel like, oh, Tom, you really get me. You understand me. But if I don't understand myself, if I can't see myself, how am I going to recognize it when you see me?
Yes.
So again, it always has to start with ourselves.
Yeah. 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 And that's so. Again, it's such a wonderful point again as well, because if I also think, just as you, this is one of the big takeaways I took from the book, and even now as you're speaking, is that if we don't know who we are, we can't explain to our significant others what we need from them to make us feel good.
Exactly. Yes. That's so true. And, you know, so spending time alone with ourselves is really important for self-awareness.
Yes.
And so many of us, you know, are really interested in other people, and we ask the right questions and we get to know our partners, but we never ask those questions of ourselves. And you can't possibly get what you want if you don't even know what that is.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people are either don't think that it's worthwhile, or they think, you know, that it's selfish to actually spend time considering, you know, who they are and what they want. But we are the one person who's going to walk beside us for the rest of our lives. We're, you know, to use like what the kids are saying on social media, we're the main characters in our own story.
Sure.
Right? It all starts with us. And you can spend your whole life never getting to know yourself, but what a waste that is.
Mm.
You know, you get to the end of your life and you've never actually lived fully because you've never spent time asking yourself those questions.
Mm.
And I know just like what was a really significant example for me, but just one example was, you know, after my divorce, I was in a series of relationships with very particular kind of man. I thought that what I needed was, you know, one like a very kind of high achieving man who had, you know, big or interesting career. I thought that's what I was looking for. And, you know, someone very charismatic and someone who I guess could elevate me by being next to someone, you know, who I consider to be important or special.
Mm.
And it wasn't until I kind of stopped dating and decided just to be on my own that I eventually asked myself, what is it that I actually want from a relationship, assuming that I will ever have one again? And it took a lot of introspection, and I realized it wasn't about any of the qualities in the other person. You know, a lot of women will say, I want someone tall, or I want somebody really wealthy, or I want somebody, you know, with kids or no kids, or it's all qualities. And in fact, I tried to imagine what I would want in a relationship. And, you know, I came up with two answers. And the two answers were, one, I want a relationship where I never get tired of spending time with the other person. So whatever that person looks like, it wasn't about the qualities in that person, it was a feeling I would get in the relationship. And the other was, I wanted someone with whom I felt safe.
Yes.
And I could too, I had never had both of those at once in any relationship. I'd had interesting people with whom I didn't feel safe, or people with whom I felt safe but weren't interesting. Didn't stimulate me, didn't fully enjoy their company. And just knowing that about myself made it possible for me to recognize that relationship when it came along. If I hadn't asked myself those questions, I still would have been chasing these kind of, you know, weird other qualities. And it's the same with career. You know, I ask myself, what do I actually want from my career? It doesn't mean you're going to get it. I mean, you might say, right, I want to be a Hollywood martial arts star. And, you know, you'd probably have to start, you know, doing martial arts now. But, you know, it doesn't mean that you can get it, but it gives you an idea of where you want to go, and you can at least make a start.
Yes.
And things as simple as, what do I want to eat tonight? You know, so many people who are in relationships or have kids or are seeing other people will be, what does everybody else want to do? Just even asking yourself that question. Things like, what did I think of the movie? So something that's really important to me now is that when I see a movie, I read a book, I will ask myself what I think about it before I ask other people. I used to just reflexively, I'd finish a book and then go on Goodreads and look at what other people were saying, right? Or I'd watch a movie and ask other people who'd seen it, what did you think? Now, the first thing I will always do is just take some time and think, what did I think of that? And then I can go and look at what other people are saying. And sometimes they agree with me and sometimes they have completely different ideas, but at least then I know what I think. At least I'm getting closer to who I am.
Yes, yes. And at least in my opinion, and I feel like you and I are very aligned there, therein lies the path forward for assertiveness, even down the end of the road. You know, it's coming back to this idea of, well, hang on, what do I actually think? It's so much easier to pay attention to what other people think. Well, you don't have an opinion, so I'll just do what he says, I'll do what she says. It's like, well, hang on.
Yeah, but we're so bombarded with content.
Yes.
You know, that it's very easy to go through life now never knowing what you think, because you want to know what you think about anything. You either talk to someone or you open up your phone and there's opinions and ideas about literally everything. You know, what do people think of this new ice cream, or what do they think of this political idea, or what do they think of this person? And it's so easy to just be constantly, constantly consuming content from other people and never asking yourself, hey, you know, what are my ideas? And you need time and you need space to do that.
Yes. Yes. Kerry, I was wondering what some of the biggest lessons you took away from this journey of writing the book. There you go, I'll use that word again. From this process of writing the book and doing your research. What were some? I'm sure we probably touched on a few of them, but if you could elaborate on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, I knew that solitude and spending time, the capacity to be alone, was really important for self-awareness, for creativity. One thing I learned is that it's incredibly important for emotional regulation. So, again, the more stimulation that you have, and when you're constantly consuming content, whether it's, you know, in conversations with other people, whether it's from your phone, whether it's from social media, it's very hard to emotionally regulate yourself. And we really need time and space just to sit with our feelings, process our difficult emotions. I mean, you'd obviously know this as a therapist.
Still need to practice it.
Yeah. And we all need to practice that. So time to sit with ourselves just to calm ourselves and work through those difficult emotions. The only way through pain is to actually sit with it. And again, we as a society, we're so bad at dealing with pain. We tend to see pain as like this terribly aberrant state. And, you know, I just was looking the other day at books on happiness, and there are so many books on how to be happy, and we should be happy, and 20 ways to be happy. You know, instead of, I guess, understanding that life is difficult and we will have happy and pleasurable moments, but pain is normal and a part of life. And so instead of running from it, we need to be able to sit with that. One of the most interesting to me that I really had no idea about until I started researching was that we need time alone to develop our moral courage. To develop our moral center. And that was really fascinating. I read some research by a historian called Hannah Arendt, who was a Holocaust survivor. And she sat in on the trials of Adolf Eichmann, who was a notorious Nazi officer, SS officer. And she concluded at the end of the trial that he wasn't inherently evil. There was nothing about him that was this, you know, a born satanic, malevolent person. She said that he committed terrible acts of evil more out of a failure to think. And she called it the banality of evil. And when people fail to stop and take stock of what they're doing, then they can fall into, you know, doing terribly bad things. And that was also supported by, other research. There's an Australian journalist, Ginger Gorman, who I know, who wrote a book called Troll Hunting, about people who, you know, go online and troll other people. And then Van Baden wrote a book on QAnon about conspiracists. And in both cases, it's often just this failure to stop and reflect on what they're doing. Mm. And the conspiracy theorists are fascinating because so often when you analyze what it is that they believe, they can't quite explain. It's not like a cohesive system of thought, and it's not like they can explain coherently, well, this is what I believe and this is why I'm doing this. They fall into these rabbit holes and they start identifying with other conspiracists, and then the truth becomes not what is actually true or real or makes sense. The truth becomes what everybody else in the group believes. And if they just stopped and took themselves out of it and spent some time sitting and contemplating, chances are it would kind of break that spell. Yeah. So we need, to summarize, we need time alone. We need reflection and contemplation and time without other input to develop our moral conscience, to develop our moral center, and to reflect on whether we actually believe in what we're doing. So it's so important to carve out that time. And that was probably the greatest surprise for me.
I really like that part too, because it gives you almost like a warning, you know, as to what can happen if you're only in the world and not within the self.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. And this is why people, you know, fall down these internet rabbit holes, because sites like YouTube, all of the social media sites just feed you one thing after another, and then it can become more and more and more radicalized. And people literally can sit at their computers for, you know, 20 hours at a time consuming all this content. And it's like, you know, programming for, like, you know, for people who fall into cults, they keep them awake, they keep, you know, keep inputting content, and it's the same kind of thing, but it's social media that's doing it to us. So we need to be able to break away and reflect and stop and think and go internally instead of constantly, you know, all this external information.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a funny world, because I reflect on what you're saying, then I can see that within myself, and I'm very interested in speaking with people and nuance and so forth. And I can sometimes hold back on what I want to say because of some sort of perceived fear of someone having a negative opinion about that, you know, even though, you know, the intention is always to learn and to grow, you know, and some people call it the court of public opinion. And I think in this day and age, when everyone is entitled to express an opinion directly to the person stating that opinion, there's going to be someone that doesn't agree with it.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a learning thing to get good at that. But yeah,
it is. Actually, if you want to get good at that, become an opinion writer, because it's something that you really learn doing opinion writing, is that you can write something that, you know, 1,000 people will love and agree with and leave comments and say how great it is, and then there'll always be a handful who tell you that you're an absolute moron or what the hell are you talking about. And you know, you can never please everybody. There's no idea that's going to resonate with it, you know, with everybody. And I think, related to what we've been talking about, I think the more confident that I feel in myself, that I do believe what I'm saying, the less that kind of thing bothers me. I'm the only time that negative comments have ever bothered me with something that I've written, certainly in recent times, you know, since it was different when I was very new and starting out and you just want everybody to like your stuff. But in recent times, very occasionally I've I've written something that I then think afterwards, oh God, you know, I messed up that bit, or I got that a bit wrong. And then the criticism really bothers me because I think, well, they're right. You know, I stuffed that up. But if I'm confident in what I said, if it's my truth, if I, you know, feel happy with whatever I've written, then I really deeply understand that some people won't agree with it, and that's okay. And I think it's the same with everything. I think, you know, if I turn up and I'm wearing something that I'm happy with and I like my outfit and somebody says, oh, what's with the shoes? I'll be like, oh, well, you don't have to like it. But if I'm feeling insecure about it, then it will really hurt me, or with a hairstyle, or with a meal I've cooked, or you know, something I've said. So I think that the more confident we are in ourselves, the less that, you know, the other people's criticism bothers us. But that, again, is a skill that we need to develop. And
definitely.
That also is something that comes, I think, with age and
and
with being comfortable spending time alone and being able to give ourselves that kind of validation. You know, when you can give yourself validation, when it's important that you are proud of yourself, other people's feelings become slightly less significant and hurtful.
Yes, yes. Did it really help? I mean, that's a really interesting point. I can imagine, based upon what you're saying, that this process of writing this book and then actually getting to know yourself and spending time with yourself would have really helped your career in opinion pieces.
Yeah, well, to write a really good opinion piece, you need to have a really strong thesis and a really strong opinion. And a couple of things happen. Like, now that I feel more confident in myself, I am much more confident saying, you know, I would rather not write something if I don't really believe it. There's been just a very, very a handful of occasions over my career, and it's been, you know, I've been doing this for quite a while, when, say, an editor has asked me to write something, or you know, occasionally you get a call saying, oh, could you, you know, do you have anything to say about this? And you want to please them, so you put something together. And now I'd rather say no. Nah. You know, I don't have anything to say about that. I'm quite comfortable saying no, I don't have anything to say. And if I do have an opinion, I'm much more confident saying, right, this is what I believe, but I understand that not everybody will agree with me, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And I just feel much more okay with people disagreeing with me in general, because I take the time to reflect on what I believe and what I feel and my decisions. And I'm not just talking about writing, I'm talking about with parenting or with, you know, other career decisions, or you know, something that I might want to do or say. If I am confident in myself, then it bothers me less when other people don't agree with me. And there will always be people who don't agree with me, because everybody is different and no one idea resonates with everybody. Now, I'm not perfect. I haven't magically become like a perfectly self-actualized person. There are still times when I really, really want, you know, my partner to like something that I've done, or
totally.
You know, I feel really, you know, disappointed if somebody doesn't, you know, like this article. But it, for the most part, I'm much more comfortable.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I suppose that is it, isn't it? I think a friend of mine, a dear friend, a psychologist, said, you know, we're in the business of helping people feel shit better.
Yeah, exactly.
I really love that. It's just so.
It's really good.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, because life is really hard, and I still have. Everybody has challenges. You know, life is challenging, and sometimes I'll kind of be pretty sure how I want to proceed, and sometimes I really won't, or I'll second guess myself, or, you know, life. The thing is, you know, especially with things like parenting and relationships, you know, you'd never get to a point where, oh, I've worked it out now. Because people are constantly changing. I'm constantly changing. The people in my life are constantly changing, which means that you're constantly needing to check in with yourself, with other people, to reflect how other people are moving forward. So, you know, you can never get a handle on parenting, for example, because your kids are constantly getting older, and this is now the first time I've had a 24-year-old, a 22-year-old, and a 15-year-old. I worked out how to deal with them when they were 20 and 18 and yes. 10, but now it's different again.
Yes.
So
respect.
And even with friendships and relationships, everybody is changing. And with my career, I'm working with new editors, and you know, the landscape of the media world is changing, the landscape of the publishing world. So that's why it's also so important to constantly be reflecting and contemplating, how do I feel now that this is the world around me? How do I want to proceed now? Because we never get there, like, to the finish line and say, oh, right, I've got it now, I've worked it all out. like I'm an expert now. It never happens because everything is constantly changing. So the most that you can do is keep trying to reflect and ask yourself questions and check in with yourself and figure out what it is that you want and believe at any given time.
With the way things are changing, how do you see your career growing and molding, given the culture and given, yeah?
God, I mean, that is like the billion-dollar question. I don't know. It's every single time I write an opinion piece, I think that's it. That's the last idea I have. I'm out of ideas now. I've said everything.
That's it. Yeah,
I have nothing else to say. I'm done. And then, you know, so far I seem to keep having ideas, but I will tell you today, no, I feel like I'm done.
Yes, that's you. Very good. Hey, I'm great finished. Way to finish it.
Yeah. And, you know, I've written 5 books and, you know, there are times when I think I've said everything. I'm so proud of this book. This really was the most personal and important and, you know, the responses have been really, really gratifying. You know, people have said this has changed my life, which is incredible. So I think, how can I follow that? You know, do I have anything else to say? But then, you know, I wake up and think, oh, God. Yeah, I can really, I really want to write about this. So the long and short is at this point, I'll probably write something else, but I can't tell you exactly what it is or when it will be.
Yes.
And also I just love to write and I'm happiest writing and whether or not, you know, ultimately as a writer, you want other people to read it, but I find writing incredibly cathartic and helpful for me to work out who I am and what I think about things. And I just enjoy the process. So, you know, as well as my 5 books, I've got like 3 manuscripts that didn't ever get published, that were just really important for me to write. So I'll write, but who knows when or what it'll be, you know, if it's on your shelf.
Yeah. Yeah. At definitely. Any
time.
Yeah. Definitely. You make me, think of a quote there. I've had the honor of interviewing, you know, lots of interesting people and, one thing that really comes true for me is when someone really is an expert in their craft, it's not because they wanted the outcome necessarily to be able to hold a book. It's because their craft is simply an expression of who they are. And there's a beautiful book, very small book called Mastery by George Leonard, who was a writer in the 20th century. And he studied a lot of kind of things about human potential and mastery and so forth, obviously. And he said that he was watching Larry Bird play basketball and really looking at the sports stars at the time. And he said that the reason they practice so much is because it's not practice isn't something that you do, it's something that you are, you know. Yeah. So for you and being a writer and having been able to touch so many people, including myself, with this work, and also just side note, it's wonderfully vulnerable, which gives us all an opportunity to get to know a deeper Kerry, which is fantastic for me because, you know, you came on the show and already had all these things I want to talk to you about, just as a side note, but you can tell, you know, and I think with writers, especially really good writers, they can disseminate potentially complicated things very simplistically in a way that can actually reach a varied audience. That really came through. It was a very, very, I read it in about 3 days, Kerry. I really did. Awesome. I just couldn't put it down. I read it every morning. And to me, that really is a reflection of someone who has really honed their craft and someone who loves their craft, you know. So thank you for that. And
That's lovely. Thank you. I'm so glad.
Yeah. No, I really loved it. And I really did. And that's why I wanted you on the show. And yeah. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Kerry. What's where can people find you?
I'm off Twitter now, which is now Twitter. I used to be very into Twitter. I'm off Twitter now. So you can find me on Facebook at Kerry Sackville Online, Kerry with an I, and I'm on Instagram at Kerry Sackville, again with an I. So I do check in with both of those, but I'm definitely not on social media as much as I was, not on Twitter anymore, not on LinkedIn. I tried Threads for, I think, 2 days and was like, nah, this is not serving me. So yeah. I limit it to those two, but I am definitely contactable and I do respond to all my messages and always happy to hear from people. It's lovely to hear from people who've read the book. because that's why you write it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's a great book, and we'll put all of your links in the show notes as well. And The Secret Life of You. It certainly can change you, but it can change the world too. So
yeah,
a little subtitle.
Let's hope so. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Kerry. Thank you for your time.
Such a pleasure.
Beautiful. Thank you, guys. Speak to you next week. Bye-bye.